Nice to be back and see so many people who I know. It's really lovely. So thank you for being here. Thank you for joining. And it's especially sweet to see so many people who are able to have their video on today. And I completely understand why you might not, but if you can, I love it. You know, I love seeing your faces. I keep my view on gallery view because then I feel like I'm really in the room with you. And I encourage you to do the same thing. But if vision is a thing and you need the speaker view, put the speaker view on. If your internet is an issue, take the video off. Do what you need to do. But also at the same time, if you can for a moment, just take a look around at each other's faces. You know, we're just greeting each other. We don't really know who's looking at whom when, but you can know that you're being seen and you're seeing others. And from the beginning, right from here, we come into this felt sense of connection and belonging and how important that is to know that you belong, that you're part of this Sangha, whether it's your first time here. Anybody first time coming to our Sangha today? Oh, Sandy, welcome, Rick. Welcome. This is great. Carlita and I were just talking about, isn't it amazing that new people come? People keep finding our Sangha. It's fantastic. So it's uplifting and a very deep, warm welcome to you and everybody else. So what we'll do here shortly is start with an arriving meditation, and then I will offer some Dharma thoughts before our longer meditation. We'll have our longer meditation, and then I'll offer a little bit longer Dharma talk. But I'm going to be here next week also, and I have a lot I want to share. So we'll just get as far as we get today, and then we'll pick it up next week. So that's an invitation to come to part two next week if we don't get through this one today. You remember those shows, maybe when we were all younger, that it would say to be continued, like the cliffhanger, to be continued? I don't know that I have a cliffhanger, but we're going to continue into next week as well. So welcome yourself into your body and your mind and your heart. And let's arrive here together in an arriving meditation, where we just get here and settle, sensing into the state of mind, heart, letting the body find a place to be where it can experience some settledness, some comfort. The breath comes and goes. And there's nothing else to do except come in, arrive and settle. Whatever the posture is, whether you're seated or standing or reclining, sense into that. The bends of any joints, the sensation of touch, maybe noticing sounds nearby or a little further away. Maybe even noticing the motion the body makes in response to the breathing. Arriving and settling and being here, listening in. If there's anywhere in the body that feels maybe a little uncomfortable or there's some tightness, see if you can soften any amount, releasing any amount by turning the awareness inward and downward, connecting with this earth in some way that you can feel the support from below, and letting any tightness flow down into the earth. We'll begin with this poem from Mark Nepo called Being Here. Transcending down into the ground of things is akin to sweeping the leaves that cover a path. There will always be more leaves, and the heart of the journey, the heart of our own awakening, is to discover for ourselves that the leaves are not the ground, and that sweeping them aside will reveal a path. And finally, that to fully live, we must take the path and continually sweep it. You know, that's one of my very favorite poems, and poems are a doorway for me into practice in many, many ways. I want to read that to you again because I think it points to so much of what we're doing. Being here, transcending down into the ground of things is akin to sweeping the leaves that cover a path. There will always be more leaves, and the heart of the journey, the heart of our own awakening, is to discover for ourselves that the leaves are not the ground, and that sweeping them aside will reveal a path. And finally, that to fully live, we must take the path and continually sweep it. Isn't that beautiful? Begin and keep going. Don't be fooled by you think you got there. Keep going. There's so much here. There is no end to this. And that's the beauty of it. This is all about this practice over and over again, showing up. And it reminds me of that beautiful, pithy teaching from Suzuki Roshi. I believe it was Suzuki Roshi, when one of his students said to him, "Really, Roshi, in all of your teaching, what is the most important thing?" And he says, "To find out what is the most important thing." And that's this continuing to sweep, that the heart of our awakening is this curiosity, this being with whatever is here. And we obviously need courage and heart and, you know, everything that it takes to do this. So I love that poem. And it was one of the early poems many, many years ago that said to me, pay attention to poems, pay attention to poetry. Because it has become such a doorway in for me into the Dharma, because poets are they see the world differently, right? I mean, if this is something that's important to you, or maybe it hasn't been important to you, but there's a poem that somehow shows up in your life and it opens something up. All right, so I love that poem. Just keep sweeping. Just keep sweeping. I have been away for much of the last month, 3 of the last 4 weeks, and I'm sort of still digging out of all of my correspondence. So if I owe you an email, I know I do. But what I've been doing for a part of that is I got to attend a retreat in Colorado in the Rockies as a student for 10 or 11 days. And it was such a pleasure to fully occupy a student role, because first and foremost, way before I ever sit in this seat and offer these teachings, I'm a student just like everybody else. And it was a retreat that was based on Ecodharma. And there's a center called the Rocky Mountain Ecodharma Retreat Center, which is very impressive, beautiful, small place that is really dedicated to how are we going to meet these times through the lens of the Dharma. And these times are specifically talking about the ecological crisis that we have. And I've been thinking a lot about, I don't think that Ecodharma is limited to specifically only climate or only, well, I don't want to say it like this. I think eco is everything. And I am very committed to the natural world, and it's where I feel best. But I also know that there's an Ecodharma of relationships. There's an Ecodharma of, within communities, within families, the ecology, the homeostasis, the balance of everything that goes into keeping things thriving or just at least in balance. And, balance, we know that balance changes all the time, but we have systems that are self-regulating or we train in regulation. And so we know that the ecology is out of balance and it's very hard to have regulation right now. The self-regulating capacity of the earth is being deeply challenged. So, as you may be very familiar with, that at the start of many Buddhist retreats, certainly in the insight tradition, we begin with refuges and precepts. And I love that. And we were outside a lot, and the Dharma talks are outside around a campfire, and it was, right up my alley, truthfully. I was just really my thing. But if you've ever been in any kind of Dharma circle where one takes refuge, takes the precepts, commits to a certain citizenship, commits to creating a caring community, a sangha for that period of time, you might hear it in a very serious, tender, beautiful way, or it might just go right by you, like, oh yeah, we always do that. And that would be normal, right? That sometimes we really hear things and sometimes it's just routine. We don't. So I've been doing this for a long time. And I think that I've had both experiences of, okay, now we're doing refuges and precepts. And I've had times where I actually really deeply connect to the refuges and precepts. And that's where I am more often than not. And as we were sitting outside around this fire, and one of the teachers was guiding us in refuges and another guiding us in precepts, I had such a connected experience of, oh yeah, I really do take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. I really do keep these precepts as part of my inner compass. And in doing that is not just saying, yes, I agree. It is about what does this really mean in my life? But it was a deeper, heartfelt sense of, I like taking refuge. I like being reminded of the goodness of the Buddha, what he represented, what that ultimately represents in me, how that comes alive, how I trust the Dharma, the way of things, the nature of things, also what the Buddha taught. And I certainly am no Buddhist scholar, so I couldn't tell you that I trust all of the teachings. What I can tell you is that what I've learned, I have found to be trustworthy. And it has been come to be a place of very real reliability, consistency. And certainly, you know, the beauty of this Sangha, and the Sangha changes all the time, right? It's the group of us who gets together at any given time, but there's a like-mindedness that is here. And I know that I need to be part of Sangha, the greater Sangha, the smaller Sanghas. And so what happened for me is I was sitting around this fire and I thought, oh, I really belong here. And if you've ever had that sense of, oh yeah, these are my peeps, right? I mean, there's a lot of ways to say it. This is my tribe. It's such a good feeling, isn't it? That sense of you don't have to share your story, but we actually know that we have these like values. And being in that place, there's a way in which I can say for me, my heart can relax. I don't have to say a word. I can just relax and be part of. So just to talk for a few minutes about refuge and Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, the earth, refuge and silence also. It is the idea of taking refuge is recommitting to a path of practice in which awakening can unfold. And doing it with others. And when I talk about awakening, I think it can only be from my own perspective, right? Like we can each read about what is awakening, what is enlightenment, but that's all very conceptual. It's all very up here in our minds. But what are those times I think about? What are those times when I have come to understand something in a much deeper way? And in that depth of understanding, it changes me a little bit. I think of that as a moment of awakening. And there are ways in which many teachers, like monastics and these deep lineage holders, who talk about many moments, many, many awakenings, and that there are these mini moments of deepening understanding that grow and that contribute to the whole of it. So actually an aspect of joy from Sayadaw Utejaniya, he says, you should be happy when you know or understand anything. Isn't that a great line? You should be happy when you know or understand anything. So in that moment of, I understand, I got it. Take that in as part of the practice deepening, the mind getting wider and clearer and the heart stronger. So I think that's what part of what I experience with refuge is. So taking refuge in the Buddha, committing ourselves to the possibility of awakening. Because if we think about the historical Buddha, who, from the perspective of the Theravada, he was a regular man who figured out the causes of suffering and how to be released from the causes of suffering, dukkha and the end of dukkha. So we can use him as an example, a historical figure who figured out his mind by sitting down and watching it, figured out his heart by all these experiences of what increases suffering and what decreases it, and stop doing the things that cause the suffering and start doing more of the things that increase the well-being. So this is a guy that figured it out, right? So that's wisdom. So I can take refuge in that possibility. And ultimately, you know, we do it through figures of people who we honor, people who we really respect. And it could be people, it could be friends, it could be family members. It could be anybody who shows up in our life that is a role model for us in some way. But ultimately, what we're doing is taking refuge in our own goodness, in our own Buddha nature. This is what we are peeling back the layers to come in contact with, to train in, and to see that we are already good. We are already wise, but we forget. And there's so many conditions that cause an armoring, that cause a disconnection from ourselves, that cause these levels of doubt, unworthiness. And my hunch is we all get what I mean by that. And so we come back over and over again to be with each other, to take refuge in what is possible. And we do it together because we need each other's strength. So I'm just kind of thinking about these refuges as a framework. And then we'll talk about the precepts in a few minutes, which is sort of like the scaffolding that puts the framework together. It's just an image I got this morning as I was preparing. So to take refuge in the Dharma, committing ourselves to a path of awakening through awareness, the teachings of the Buddha, the way things are. We learn it from our own direct experience. And I really have been finding myself moving away from using language like the truth. I think many things are true, but there isn't one truth. And it feels more freeing to me. Like I can be part of a tradition or a practice that isn't dogmatic or self-righteous or fundamental. One that when the Buddha actually said, find out for yourself. That means there are a lot of different ways to do this, not one way. And I was raised to ask questions and to think critically, not to be critical necessarily, but to say, huh, I wonder what if, and to not just say, oh, it's like this, so it's like this. So I think many things are true, and I think the Dharma, taking refuge in the Dharma, encourages that inquiry, that investigation, to find out what is true right now. But there isn't one truth, because what I think we really do find out is that many things can be true at the same time. And that is our practice, right? How do we meet the full range of joy and sorrow that is true at any one time? That's a lot of work. And so when we're not black and white, and we can actually tolerate in our hearts and in our minds and literally in our nervous systems, gray areas, ambiguities, paradoxes, that's the Dharma. That's taking refuge in that we can actually do that. And taking refuge in the Sangha, you know, this place of deep love, I think, because we show up and look who we are. Look at this. This is beautiful. Really is sweet. So we commit ourselves to a community of all beings within which awakening can unfold. And it does, because I'm not the only one who could occupy this seat in this room. I know there's a lot of wisdom here. And every time we get into conversations, and we will later, and you bring in your own wisdom, it's a rich conversation, isn't it? It really is. So you can trust your wisdom and that you are in the presence of those who honor your wisdom. So this beautiful Sangha. And I think we take refuge, the ground of all of this is this earth, the wisdom of the earth. Committing ourselves to the deep understanding of our undeniable interconnection with all things, all beings, that we are of the earth and sustained by the earth. We are not separate. And I think that we absolutely must include the earth in our practice, because we are not separate. And what we're going to talk about a lot today and probably next week is more and more of a deeper understanding of what it means to be part of everything and everyone. Because when we get it, that we're not alone, and we can't, I mean, like we can go in a room alone, I don't mean that. But what each one of us does really matters. This profound and deep and as Dan Siegel is talking now, intra-connection. And he talks about this idea of going from me to we, to I to you, I, thou, the whole thing. And he's made up a new word. Me and we is muy. And that's his new word, muy. That's what it really is. So how do we even really grok that? How do we come into relationship with that? And, you know, this whole thing about taking refuge in the earth and understanding that our safety, our sustainability, our lives are dependent on the health of the earth. This is undeniable, right? I mean, we look around and see what's happening. And the earth is speaking. The earth is speaking. And we haven't been listening. And now is our time. We have to start listening and acting appropriately. So you might consider for yourself, is there a particular refuge that feels resonant and alive for you today? You know, it can change. It can change that, yeah, this refuge in the Buddha really feels right. That's where I need to spend time. Refuge in the Dharma, refuge in the Sangha. And just let that change in its own way, because it does. You know, it does. And this is not a linear practice. All of the different lists the Buddha gave us, even though they can go from the beginning to an end of a list, they too are so completely interwoven. And you start to see what is thought of as Indra's net. Everything is connected in these nodes of connection. So start wherever you want to start, with that place that resonates, that you go, oh yeah, that one really feels poignant today. And then, so we have that as the framework, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. And I'm going through this because I think it's important to revisit these refuges, to revisit the precepts as our framework, as our scaffolding. And next week we'll talk about trust and confidence and faith as the glue. Because if you think about a framework and you think about scaffolding, something has to hold that scaffolding on so it doesn't fall over like pickup sticks. So we'll talk next week around how faith and placing the heart upon a path of practice actually brings it together. So these precepts, universal guide, common sense guidelines for cultivating a culture of ethical intelligence, actually, of community. And my hunch is you know them. And the way I want to talk about these precepts are not from a punitive place about don't do this or that, but actually what can we do? Because when we approach anything from, and here's a way, from don't do it, the don't do it is like a stick, right? And here's what you can do is, to me, it's like a carrot. So psychologically, we like carrots better than we like sticks. So this is kind of a, you know, silly way to put it, but you get it. So we undertake a training to not cause harm. That's what this whole thing is about. How can we study non-harming, and what does that mean? And it's an ongoing study. And the first precept, of course, is not intentionally harming or killing any beings. So that's a big study. What do you do about mold and mosquitoes, right? What do you do about all these little things that we might think are annoyances? We get it about don't kill another human being. But it brings us into a very deep discussion of how we use things, what we eat, what we don't eat. And I'm not here to say what to do or not to do. The way I look at this is, how do we cultivate a way of living that honors and respects life? And then that will take us into things like, if we're going to honor and respect life, we need to make changes in our policies that set the stage for a thriving ocean, clean air, like that, water, food. So what do we do to support life? The second one is all around generosity and sharing our resources, even though it's written as undertaking a training to not take anything that isn't freely offered, not stealing consciously or not. Okay, so we know this, you know, this isn't like the Ten Commandments of don't steal, but it is a direction of practicing reciprocity and generosity, not assuming anything is ours necessarily just because we want it. What do we take for granted? How do we take up space? But flipping that around, the fact that you all showed up today is an act of generosity. because you're bringing your hearts and your minds and your practice to a Sangha. Any registration fees you offered today go directly to supporting me and supporting Spirit Rock so we can keep doing this, these acts of generosity. But we don't owe each other. It is not out of a punitive, you owe me, so you have to do this. That's not what we're talking about with this precept. We're talking about cultivating more of a gift economy. I value you, you value me. How do we share that? Here's this sweet poem from Hafiz that says, "The sun never says." Even after all this time, the sun never says to the earth, "You owe me." Look what happens with a love like that. It lights up the world. Isn't that sweet? Even after all this time, the sun never says to the earth, "You owe me." Look what happens with a love like that. It lights up the world. So when we take on these practices of non-harming, we become a light and we light it up for each other. The third one is not speaking in a way that causes harm. And I know Donald has been talking a lot about wise speech, and it's critically important. Obviously, look at our public discourse, but we have the opportunity to change that. And every single time one of us changes how we speak, it really helps. So I'll give you a short little story. I know I'm going on a little bit, and this is why we're going to do this in two parts. My husband and I are in the process of getting our house painted, and it hasn't been painted in far too many years. And choosing an exterior color is not easy. And we went through the process of choosing the color, and then I left for 3 weeks. He bought all this paint, and paint is expensive, and it's a big house, so it's a lot of gallons of paint. You know where I'm going with this story. And so just this week, what's today, Wednesday? So on Monday, paint, the trim color was staying the same, and the painter started putting the paint on the body of the house, and we both said, "Oh my God, no way. This is not going to work." It was so bad. It was just so bad. And we had to hurry up and figure out the next color because the painter can only be here for a certain amount of time. And so we had to, Monday afternoon, go get more samples, come back, paint samples on the house and say, okay, that one. So we did that. And then yesterday, okay, that one started going on the house. And we're like, oh my God. And my husband said, "You're the one who chose the paint color." And I thought, okay, what would Donald tell me to do? Like, how am I going to work this one? And of course, at first I said, "That's not really true. We brought a bunch of samples, we painted it on the house, and we chose that one together." He said, "Yeah, but I never wanted to change the color to begin with. You're the one that wanted to change the color." So I can see you're all laughing because you get it, right? But this is how the precepts show up. This is what I mean about how do we integrate these things into the complexity of our life, of something as basic as painting the house. So I was spinning out yesterday and I could feel all of the very, very unpleasant Vedana of what was going on, and I didn't know what I was going to do about it because I cannot go back to the paint store and change this color for a third time. What am I going to do with all of these gallons of paint? So I decided that what I really needed to do was just apologize, was just to say, "You know what, honey? This is because I wanted to change the color, and I know you didn't want to change the color. And I want to take full responsibility for where we are." And when I did that, my whole nervous system relaxed. And my husband said, well, it's okay. Do you want to go to a different color? I mean, it's like it shifted the entire conversation. And the easiest part about this was actually the taking the responsibility for it, because it took all the heat out of it. And he felt it. And then we could come back to, what are we going to do? And we are going to leave it alone. We're just going to get used to it. So here's the thing. I promise we're going to get to our meditation, but this is the thing. The house was gray with dark green trim. And I wanted to go from gray to like sage green, because just, can we just put a little color in this? So when we got the samples of all the sage green, it looked like mint, and we weren't going to paint the house mint green. So we went down this ridiculous thing that I just told you about, different greens. So now we have this very green house with darker green trim. And we live in the woods. So there are all these different colors of green around us. And it occurred to me that the house just fits perfectly in this forest of green. And the forest never says to itself, hey, you over there with that weird green, you don't fit. You don't get to be here. And so that's my Dharma explanation and rationalization about these two greens that aren't a perfect complement to each other. But the house is down here on 5 acres in the middle of the trees, and the forest is not going to say you don't belong. So that's my wise speech story, that, you know, when we can take the responsibility with a little humor and reframe a little bit, it takes the heat down. It really takes the heat down. And I have to say, I was pretty impressed with my husband saying this morning, okay, do you want to go back to the gray? Or should we just stay with this? And we're just staying with it. Because you know that Kenny Rogers song, Know When to Hold 'Em and Know When to Fold 'Em? Leave well enough alone. So it's just going to be a big greenhouse and whatever. Okay. And that brings me to Jan Chosen Bays, who's this really great Zen teacher, priest. She says, when our mind is clear, we can speak in a straightforward way with precision and without insulting others. And that's really what happened. You know, we get a little clarity and we can speak easier, and we don't have to insult each other and say, well, you're the one who made that decision, which is easy to do. And then just back up from that. All right. So the fourth precept, of course, is being careful with our bodies, not using sexual energy inappropriately, having good boundaries, being kind. I'm not going to say more about that because we understand what happens when that doesn't happen. And the last is not consuming anything to the degree that it causes heedlessness. And this is all about consumption. And at this retreat, one of the teachers said, you know, it really feels like consumption is our religion. And it's a poignant thing to think about. How do our habits of consumption get into everything that we do? What we think, what we don't think? Do we keep buying more and more paint, or do we say this is how it is? And so it's worth looking at. It's not just about alcohol and drugs and food. It's about everything. So on bottom line for these precepts is, can we undertake a training to take really good care of ourselves so we don't cause more harm to ourselves or each other or anybody else? And from the Buddha in the Dhammapada, I love this piece. He wrote, whatever path of action you find that brings good and happiness to all, follow this way like the moon in the path of the stars. Isn't that beautiful? Whatever path of action you find that brings good and happiness to all, follow this way like the moon in the path of the stars. And what I love about that is it honors our differences. It's whatever path of action you find And we don't all have to find the same path of action, but we must act for the good. That is the injunction. That is the teaching. Act for the good. And find your way. Because we need our diversity. We need all of these different ways. And Annie Lamott, who says, lighthouses don't go around the island trying to rescue ships. They just stand there and shine. We do, you know, we start shining. We're not going out rescuing everybody. What we are doing is standing here, doing what we can. But we also know our limits. We also know our limits. And that piece that I brought in last month from the Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, who says, stand in your strength so others can find you. Standing in your strength allows others to find you. It is what we're doing. So thank you for that very longer than I planned discussion of refuges and precepts. But let's move into our meditation. So finding, once again, a comfortable posture, whether you're seated or reclining or standing. Breathing and knowing you're breathing. Let your shoulders drop a little. Relaxing the face, even unhinging the jaw. Soft belly breathing, maybe. See if you can relax the muscles of the chest and the belly and sense how the breath can get all the way down to the belly. Breathe and know you're breathing. Be in your body and know being in your body. And letting the mind relax also. And bringing to mind if there was a particular refuge, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, the earth, that feels most resonant for you today. Let that accompany you. And then of the precepts of honoring life, speaking kindly, offering your presence, your generosity, being careful with your body, being aware of consumption. Maybe there's one of those precepts that also feels resonant. Keep that with you. And then resting the awareness, the attention, right where it makes most sense for you, whether it's in the breath or the body, maybe your metta practice, whatever it is. Resting the attention there. When the mind wanders, gently coming back and beginning again. Over and over again, and truly being gentle and kind as we sit together quietly. wherever the mind is, if it's not right here with your present moment experience, come back. Sensing the breath coming and going, in, out. Sensing the body right here, stable, connected. And if any habitual tightness is present, see if you can release a little bit. Any amount is the right amount. Settling back in. Noticing any amount of quiet and stillness that is inside of you. Maybe noticing the quiet and stillness that might be around you, any amount. And letting that quiet, that stillness be in the forefront of your awareness now, shifting from paying attention to touch or breath to the quiet itself. See if you can sense into that quiet and letting that also be a refuge, a place of comfort, reliability. Resting there, the open invitation to rest in that which is quiet. And right in this moment, bringing in a quality of savoring, to be truly present with any sense, any feelings of what feels good, of really tasting this moment. How does it feel on the inside? Any amount of what you would consider pleasant. Right here, taking that in. Savoring, not grasping, but truly being very present with it. And then drawing the awareness into the heart center. Maybe even placing a hand on the heart, on the chest, connecting the warmth of your own body with the intention of goodness from your heart. Reminding yourself that you're already good. And beginning to move into this practice of the heart's breath, if you like. Imagine every inhale comes into the heart, infuses with fresh energy and nourishment every nook and cranny of this heart space. And then as you breathe out, the heart's a little stronger, maybe a little more spacious, releasing your goodness out into the world, but also releasing anything that wants to be let go of. Goodness in, nourishment in, goodness out, whatever you don't need out, this heart's breath. And maybe if you like, bringing to mind anybody, any being from any time of your life who you know has been helpful to you, or maybe someone you've been helpful to them, getting that sense of care between you. Maybe there's even a felt sense in the heart of this reciprocity, this shared caring between you. Here's a poem from Carrie Newcomer called Send Love, It Matters. Somewhere someone needs help. Send love, it matters. If you can't get there yourself, then take a deep breath. Breathe in the weight of their troubles. Breathe out and send all those burdens into the light, where sorrows can be held with the most tender and infinite grace. Breathe in what you can do. Breathe out what you can't change. Spool out a thread of connection. Send courage and calm. For the nights can be long and filled with shadows, and sometimes terrible, unexpected waters will rise. Somewhere someone needs help. Send love. It matters. Okay, let's take 5 minutes. See you at 23 after the hour. Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for coming back. So, are there any questions from everything that I brought in earlier this morning around refuges, precepts, how to engage? Any questions, anything you'd like to bring in? Or anything from the meditation? Barbara, please. Nice to see you. There you go.
I actually don't have a question, but I do want to share something that I just love about the way you present what you want us to think about. It's when you give the Dharma, so you teach the teaching, and then you give us, and this today it was hilarious, but hilarious. And then you give us like a concrete example that we can really attach the teaching to. And that makes all the difference,
doesn't it?
Like takes it away from just head stuff to actual like embodiment, like how an example. I love the way you do that. And the more you do that, the better it is, because it just gets out of, as I said, out of this intellectual place to, oh yeah.
Thank you for saying that, because that's what I meant about, I am committed to understanding how these teachings meet our lives, because otherwise it's just all up here and it's academic. And what is the point? The point is to make my life better so I can behave better. So like the paint story today, because the Dharma is everywhere.
The only thing missing, I have to say this one thing, is a picture. Color of your house.
Just think green.
I actually was trying to, at one point I thought I had a little view of out the window, and I thought, oh, I don't know.
You can't see it. Nah, you can't. Maybe
the only thing.
Maybe when it's all done, I'll take a picture and I'll put it up, and we can all just say, oh, that's great. Or you might think, oh my God. So, but this, thank you for saying that. But you know, I am serious about that, is that this is how the Dharma becomes alive and why it matters. And it really, I want to emphasize that when I had that awareness and inclination that I just needed to say to my husband, I'm so sorry I got us into this. It took away all of the heat. And the place in the Dharma that I think that one of the things that's really helped me is to see the ways that we can get so defended. And the inclination to blame, and blame is usually about that it hurts, so I need to project it somewhere else. But this practice has given me so much courage and permission to own my own stuff, that it's so, there's so much compassion and ultimately love in saying, I blew it. And what's the big deal? Because what, by doing that, I don't have to hold up any kind of false wall. I can say, yeah, I see how this happened, because I'm not taking it personally. It's not a personal reflection on my goodness or badness. It was just that, I mean, this whole thing about the thought becomes the word, becomes the action, watch our decisions and all the ripple effects. But then being able to take responsibility felt so much better than trying to hold up a defended place of, well, we chose the color together. Well, we did, but it didn't matter. And it changed everything, just saying, yeah, I see where all this came from.
Just and keep giving us examples.
My whole marriage, yeah.
That helps. That really, really.
But it really does. Helps.
I don't know if it helps other people. It really helps me to see it in practice.
Yep. Yep. And that is another part of taking refuge in the Sangha, is that I could tell you this story. I could laugh at myself. And hopefully when any of us shows up like that, what it does is it gives you permission and courage to do the same thing, because this is what we do together, is we just show up in our common humanity. That's what it is. Because who else has, I mean, have you ever, if you've, I hope all of us have had that experience of exactly the kind of thing that I'm describing, and how it can make things just so much easier. Just take responsibility, no blame. Let's stop blaming. Let's just stop blaming. Thank you, Barbara. Lily.
Thank you. Hi, thank you so much. What I wanted to share was that I feel that you, in talking about the refuges, I feel like you brought them back to my heart, that, you know, it's one of those lists I memorized a long time ago, and I feel like you really brought them back to life and connected it with everything that's going on. So thank you.
Thank you. It was really what happened for me going to this retreat and in doing the routine of taking refuges and precepts, getting that deeper place of, this actually really matters to me. And I really like taking refuge, and I feel the uplift and the support of it. And so there's a reason that these refuges and precepts exist, even for us lay practitioners. You know, so much of this has come out of the monastic tradition, but we get to participate in it in our lay lives. They matter. Thank you, Lily. Lisa Marie, hi.
I just came off retreat, 8-day loving kindness retreat. And it's really wonderful to have you talk about the precepts, because it's part of what's so hard to leave is it's so much easier to have that container.
Yeah.
To provide a container for us, you know, and like in the way that a child needs a container, I feel like that really helps me be my best self. And you've reminded me that I can, part of the skill is to develop that container for myself.
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah, and that this is the point, one of the very important reasons for going on retreat is that it is a precious, protected environment for the period of the retreat. but then to train in knowing how we can create that for ourselves, because it isn't our regular everyday life, because we're not monastics.
Yes.
So you're right. So how do you go from being in an intensive retreat in that beautiful, protected, precious environment? And reentry is not always easy.
And so I want to also thank Carlita as being part of Spirit Rock, because that's where I was.
Oh, good.
And it is, I'm so blessed to live so near to Spirit Rock. Yeah. So blessed.
Thank you. Keep nurturing all of that goodness in you.
Thank you, Heidi.
You're welcome. Anybody else? Okay. So I am beginning today's Dharma talk a half an hour after I planned. So this is why we have part one and part two. And it just feels so luxurious. Like I'm savoring that I don't have to hurry up and get it all in. That we'll be back next week and we'll just end wherever we end today and go into next week. So I want to talk about being so fully present that we're able to access all of our wisdom, all of our awareness, all of our compassion, with this idea of radical presence. And I'm just chewing on this and developing it as I'm thinking about it. And some of this has come from my own retreat. It's also just the way the Dharma unfolds. So two really important pieces from the Dhammapada that I find myself going back to over and over again. And again, the Dhammapada is the Buddha's teaching in verse, many couplets. It's a small little book. And I highly recommend it for your library if you keep Buddhist books, the Dhammapada. The Buddha says, avoid what is unskillful, do what is good, and purify the mind. This is the teachings of the Buddha. And then what I brought in earlier, whatever path of action you find that brings good and happiness to all, follow this like the moon in the path of the stars. So this first one, avoid what is unskillful and do what is good. That's pretty basic, right? But it's back to the precepts. Try to get to know your own habits. What are the things that are unskillful that cause harm? Stop doing it. And then do what is good. Yeah. Do what brings well-being and less suffering to you and those around you. And purify the mind. That is talking about, again, our precepts, but also our practice of meditation. Because when we sit down and we cultivate this bare attention, this awareness of really being in relationship with what is happening in the mind-heart, it is known as a purification practice. That, and we can go through different waves and cycles with it, where the mind can get very quiet and very still, and it can also be very agitated. But over time, I experience it like you can, you know, the glitter jar, everything is all shaken up, and sometimes it's really hard to see clearly. And over time, there is a settling. And sometimes within a given meditation, there is a settling, and there's a real clarity that comes, and the dross gets sloughed off. So those two pieces from the Dhammapada have been important to me. So again, avoid what is unskillful, do what is good, and purify the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. And these, by the way, are teachings of a lifetime. It's not like we're just going to sit down for an hour and get it and say, okay, got that one. And this is why we come back over and over again. And this other one, to know that whatever path of action that you choose that is wholesome and skillful and in line with values of non-harming, do that. You can trust it, because the path, follow this way like the moon in the path of the stars, it's so much bigger than us. That means you can trust that. And in my own familial tradition of Judaism, there is a very important teaching of Tikkun Olam, to repair the world, the repairing of the world. So as we cultivate goodness in ourselves, get to know what is already here and support it, that is a repairing of our inner world. And then that gives us the strength and the ability to meet the suffering of the world, this tikkun olam, the repairing of the world. And I particularly, you know, when I get into this practice of, yeah, how am I going to do that? There's so much that is so frightening and big. And how do we manage the sorrow of those we love when there's all this instability and destruction around us and what it's really doing? The third century rabbi, Rabbi Tarfon, says this is a quote that comes in a couple of different forms. It's not upon you to finish the work, nor are you free to desist from it. Or said a little differently, it's not up to you to finish the task, but you are not free to avoid it. So what a paradox, right? It's not all up to each one of us individually. We can't solve this individually, but we can't stop. And we need each other. So this goes to avoid what is unskillful and do what is good. And whatever path of action you choose, trust it. So how do we work this? Right? How do we really work this? And what I think we're talking about here is the path of the Bodhisattva. And in the tradition of the Bodhisattva is the one who shows up and says, the world is suffering and it's my job to meet it. The Bodhisattva who says, yeah, I'm in it. I am in this. I will work for the well-being of all beings, myself included. And last time I was here, we were talking about practices of the Bodhisattva, and it's sort of ridiculous, you know, when if we go to some of the Bodhisattva vows that say creations are numberless, beings are numberless, I vow to free them all. Delusions are inexhaustible. It keeps happening. I vow to transform them all. Reality is boundless. It just keeps going on and on, but I vow to perceive it. I'm going to understand. And this awakened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. So it's an impossible and necessary task. This piece of it's not upon you to finish the work, nor are you free to desist from it. I think this is the work of being a human and an engaged, committed, loving human. It's going to take, it always has, but we really got to show up. And we also have to take care of ourselves, because a burned out person, an exhausted person, isn't helpful. So, you know, we do the things that we need to do to nourish ourselves. And that is equally as important to the good of the whole. So we train in mindfulness. We train in this loving awareness, as Ram Dass said. And I think that truly my favorite way of thinking about what is mindfulness is what Thich Nhat Hanh said, that mindfulness in and of itself and connected to the heart allows us to look deeply and see what's going on. It means seeing and knowing what's going on. So how do we get from, I have to look deeply and see what's going on? That might be really scary, or it might not. You know, we cultivate this courage. And then really understanding. And we understand from, we can use the four foundations of mindfulness as a way to deeply understand what's going on. Awareness of the body internally and externally. I mean, these specific teachings are wonderful instructions. We are here with this body. And in this fathom-long body, the Buddha said, exist all the teachings of dukkha, the teachings of impermanence, the teachings of interconnection. It's all right here in this body. And you could give yourself the teaching, there is a body. And really study, there is a body. And we will come into intimate contact with all of these teachings. The teachings on Vedana, the second foundation of mindfulness, is a way to come into what is mindfulness and what does it mean to deeply know and see what's going on. The experience of pleasant, unpleasant, the experience of not pleasant, not unpleasant, sometimes thought of as neutral. But everything that happened, the Vedana of seeing a color that made us go, ah, right? The unpleasant Vedana everywhere and what happened from that. Seeing what is going on, coming to the awareness of what needed to be done, awareness of the mind, third foundation, fourth foundation, everything else, the hindrances, the awakening factors, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, all of these heart practices, this radical presence. And so it is critically important that we do study these foundations because, as Mary Oliver said, mindfulness without the heart is simply a report. We must connect our sila, our ethics, to our heart, to what we are aware of internally and externally, because otherwise it's a sterile technique for paying attention. And we can write a field guide. Field guides are great, but from the perspective of mindfulness, from mindful awareness, we must integrate our ethics and the heart to make it a fully alive, blossomed, flourishing, effective mindfulness. So that's this radical presence. So where I want to go with this, and I realize we have not enough time to dive in more with this. I've been thinking and studying a little bit with the Zen peacemakers. Anybody familiar with Zen peacemakers? Lily knows. Really worth looking up. So this is an organization that was started by Roshi Bernie Glassman. He's a Zen teacher who died a few years ago, a very close compatriot of Roshi Joan Halifax. And he did amazing work. What Bernie Glassman did was, he was the one who started what are known as the Bearing Witness retreats, where he would take people to Auschwitz for retreats and to really learn about bearing witness. How does this work to show up and be with what is here? And there are three tenets that the Zen peacemakers are at a core to their work. And here are the three. Showing up with beginner's mind, not knowing. The second is bearing witness. And the third is taking action. And I'm very intrigued with these tenets connected to our refuges, connected to the precepts, connected to the Buddha saying, avoid what is unskillful, do what is good, purify the mind, and choose a path of action that is beneficial to all and follow it. So one of the questions is, okay, how do we do this? And this very core teaching of show up and don't know, this don't know mind, is an open, curious, courageous willingness. Because what does it really mean to let go of fixed ideas about yourself or others, how things should or shouldn't be, and all of the ways that we have views and opinions? Because of course we have views and opinions, but our practice says, show up and see, and really see. And when Thich Nhat Hanh says mindfulness allows us to look deeply and see what's going on, that allows us part is the invitation, is the doorway in. Because when the mindfulness is alive and it comes out of a receptive mind heart, which is sati, the soft receptive quality of mind and heart that allows the mindfulness to be present, that's where the curiosity is. That's where the willingness and the courage that says, okay, I think I know what's going on here. Or we come into any situation with all kinds of ideas about what we're going to experience. or assumptions or guesses, but how do we learn to peel back those layers? What are those core limiting beliefs that we have? Core limiting beliefs, belief systems that are woven into us through our conditioning, that are core to us, that might keep us stuck, might keep us from seeing a bigger picture. So this is a training of don't know mind to try to widen out the perspective all the time, maybe reframe the narrative. I was listening to a beautiful podcast, an interview with Rebecca Solnit on Tricycle Talks. Anybody familiar with Rebecca Solnit? Look her up. She's a genius. And she's written many, many books on hope and despair. And she's doing a lot of work in the climate arena right now. And James Shaheen of Tricycle Talks just did a very beautiful interview with her. You can get it very easily on podcasts, where she's talking about reframing the narrative. And how do we take beauty and joy and imagination and renunciation and see it in a little different view? And I'll talk more about that next week. So how do we reimagine? I mean, we can look at what our climate crisis is and say, we have air that isn't healthy. We have water that isn't healthy. We have substandard food in lots of places. We have food deserts. We have all kinds of problems. But what if we shift our approach to what do we need to let go of in order to create the narrative of thriving oceans, of food security, etc.? Instead of, I mean, we have to shift from business as usual and it's all going down the drain to, wait a minute, we have a choice here. How do we shift into a more hopeful place? And what is the role that each one of us has? It's not up to you to finish the work, nor are you free to desist from it. We come back to that. So we notice these core limiting beliefs, notice our maybe baked in narrative, and ask ourselves, what else is possible here? And remember the question that we've talked about a lot in here, what else is true? And this is an important question. What is still true? What is still true is we have a tremendous crisis on this planet in many ways. Yeah, that is true. We know that. What else is possible? What else is true? The beauty of our Sangha, the nurturing capacity of this, what we can do in this practice, how this practice shows up in our lives. And really interesting, and this is the work of Richie Davidson, the neuropsychiatrist, he's identified an actual circuit in the brain that is responsible for the ability to reframe, to shift our outlook. That's pretty amazing. That when we ask the question, what else is true? What else might be possible? We're opening up a different place in the brain to reframe. And that's not to say that we are bypassing or papering over, but we're coming to a bigger perspective of what else can be. And you know, there's that line in the Metta Sutta at the very end, towards the end, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, having given up unwholesome sense desires, is freed from suffering. So to look at how fixed views really do influence our lives, our actions, our thoughts, and try to get underneath that, we get into that place of not knowing, of don't know mind, this first tenet of the Zen peacemakers. So over the next week, maybe we just take this on, notice your fixed views, and don't be hard on yourself about it. We all have them. We have core limiting beliefs. It's part of what gives us our structure, our framework, our stability. Like, no, I set my life up like this because I believe that. We're all like that. We have this conditioning. But just notice them. Notice if it's a view or an opinion that has a lot of strength under it, or maybe it's like a little bit lighter, and just reflect on it. Try to avoid the inner critic. It's not that any view is wrong. Just notice the existence of it, the presence of it, and how it ripples in your life. And then we'll take this up next week. We'll take it up, but we have time for one or two questions on that, if you'd like. Anybody at all? Okay, so as you notice the fixed views, and if you have the inclination towards being hard on yourself, come back into your heart, knowing that it's just normal. And as we continue this exploration of peacemaking, know that even though it's not upon you to do all the work, but you can't stop, there's a way in which we can cultivate a little bit of hope. Hope is active. Hope is not sitting in the chair and saying, well, yeah, I hope it really changes. It's actually acting for the good, right? It's that peace that there still yet is goodness. So here's a poem from James Cruz that we'll end on. It's called Messengers of Hope. Hope slips into the house unannounced, like seeds that cling to my husband's jeans when he comes home from the farm fields, the cottony fluff of milkweed and thistle, the seed heads of ryegrass, all drifting across the mudroom floor into every corner, waiting among ribbons of old cobwebs to be swept up later, taken back outside. It's the way of the world, life biding its time until it finds that one chance in a million and bursts into some wild new version of itself that had lived inside from the very start. Like the puffball mushroom we brushed past while harvesting the last of the Brussels sprouts, how they sent out spores at the slightest touch, countless messengers rising up around us in a cloud of rich smoke, riding the gust of every breath we took. Messengers of hope. Okay, I just have to say one more thing because I got 2 minutes. Did you see that a federal judge in Montana this week upheld what a group of young teenagers did? They sued Montana to say, you have to stop ruining our environment, and they won. So come on, what else is true, right? Messengers of hope. Like, look at everybody smiling and nodding. It wasn't up to any one of those kids, but they did it together, and a federal judge heard it and said, yes, you're right. How uplifting is that? Okay, everybody, biggest love to you. We offer up the goodness of our practice for all beings everywhere because we are making a difference so that everyone everywhere, human and non-human, are safe and protected and have enough to eat and have shelter and have what they need to flourish. Hope to see you next week, everybody. Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.